Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Slapcast. This is episode 2 of our coverage of the 2023-24 season. I'm your host, Gage, as usual, and not only are we back, but the Premier League is back as well, baby, and it's so nice to finally be able to say that. But before I turn us all loose to serenade, soliloquize, and stipulate about opening weekend, I first have to remind you that two other voices and faces will be stimulating the senses for you tonight. The first of those, of course, is Ethan. Hello, Ethan.
Hello, Gage. I'm glad to be able to stimulate the senses with you.
You're a very charming individual, shall we say.
Whoa, thank you. Don't play with me right now. I'll give you a big old smooch.
And Reese is back again as well. Hello, Reese.
Hello. I'm not going to give you a
smooch. You're not very charming.
Yeah, that's okay.
How are you doing, Gage?
I'm feeling great. I'm a little bit perturbed because I have to present the fact that we are without Josh tonight, as he and his wife have moved halfway across the country and are currently in the process of dealing with all that that entails. So we are without Josh, but we are not without the question of the day, thanks to Ethan. So he'll be fulfilling that role.
Oh, gosh. Okay, this has probably been asked before, but I'm looking at one of my magnets on my board right now. And that helped me come up with a question on the spot. Do y'all have a favorite ice cream flavor?
Cookies and cream.
That's a good one.
I am uninspiring and I like chocolate.
Chocolate's good.
Let me shout out Andy's frozen custard.
Yes.
Because I am an Andy's stan, specifically the triple chocolate concrete. It is
love a triple
quite
chocolate.
A bit of chocolate. However, I love chocolate and it goes crazy.
Yeah. I mean,
what are the three chocolates? I can't even remember. It's the actual custard is chocolate.
Yeah. And then they've stuck like brownie chunks in it and
is it something Heath? Else. I think it might be Heath.
Maybe, yeah.
Or something like that. But it's so good.
Yeah. I mean, Andy's was a staple in our high school years.
Yeah.
It was.
I like a lot of ice cream flavors. There's one ice cream place that's like right next to where I went to college, and it has like a bee's knees flavor. It's like lavender. Sounds weird. Really good though. But typically, if I were to grab like a pint or a quart of an ice cream of some sort, I would get like Neapolitan. Like I love the combination of chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry all in one. Yeah, just simple like that. I do like cookies and cream and shout out to Andy's. That flavor is nice as well. But yeah, I thought of it because I have this Ben & Jerry's magnet on my thing. And it was holding up this Polaroid that we took all together.
Before you can see my face reflected in the bottom.
We just stretched out face.
But yeah, all the boys awesome. Yeah. On Josh's goodbye party.
Yeah.
So... All right, good question. I do think strawberry is kind of an underrated flavor too, by the way. I liked your shout out to Neapolitan there. We are going to play a little bit of segment roulette this season. We are going to be introducing a couple of new segments across the episodes that you might find interesting. The first of which this weekend is champs and chumps of opening weekend. So each of us have selected a champ for this weekend, and we've all selected a chump as well. So we're going to go through and discuss our picks for that. Let us know your picks as well as your favorite ice cream flavor, by the way, in the comments below. Please respond. Let us know your champ and chump and ice cream flavor. Now, I'm going to go first. We'll go champs first and then chumps. I'll go first. My champ this week, and Ethan, you just might want to turn off the podcast at this point because my champ this week is Brighton's recruitment department. Not even forsaking the ridiculous profit that they just made on Caicedo. This weekend, they featured goals from João Pedro and Simon Adingra, who cannot stop scoring at the moment through preseason up till now. He was acquired from Nordsjælland in Norway last summer for less than £10 million, spent last season on loan at Union in Belgium, and he's come back, looks like he's Premier League ready. I mean, he was on for 10 minutes and made a huge difference. Granted, they were already up in the game, but he scored, so he's one to keep an eye on. Of course, João Pedro, we knew he was going to be a success. Reese talked about him at length when he signed. Underratedly, debutant James Milner, who tied the record for consecutive Premier League seasons at 22, put in a comprehensive performance at right back, was characteristically industrious, as always. And then Mahmoud Dahoud in the middle, who has essentially profiled as a direct replacement to Alexis McAllister, partners Pascal Gross just the same way, adds the technicality to the midfield, and they got him on a free, which is a crazy piece of business. So unfortunately for Ethan, as that is, I mean, this weekend was just a showcase, really, of what good sound recruitment can still get you in the modern game, even it's with all these crazy prices.
They can continuously, season after season, sell their best player, or in this case, their best players. They sold McAllister and Caicedo, and they don't look phased at all.
And the annoying thing about that is that, like, I saw like a list of all the players they've sold over the few seasons, and it's like stupid money. Yeah. But then, like, I'm comparing it to what I've got going on at Palace, and we're selling like one of our best assets for their release clause of $35 million. So it's quite a miserable time right now.
It's not even just stupid money. It's stupid profit. Cause like you can sell players for a lot, but like if you bought them for a lot, who really cares? But like,
yeah,
I think I saw a graphic that their profit over the last couple of seasons is like $311 million or something like that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I totally believe it too, because you think about all the high pro. I mean, you got the McAllister and Caicedo deals, Cucurella from last summer, and there was another high profile one that I can't remember from, I think, either last summer or the summer. Ben White, yeah. I mean, and he hardly even played for Brighton. He was on loan for a large portion of his time at the club. Yeah. So, yeah, just ridiculous stuff from them all around. So, anyway, that was my champ for the week. I'll pass it on to Reese to get his champ.
So my champ has been a long-awaited debut for me personally, because I have a soft spot for this player in my heart, mainly through FIFA, which sounds funny, but I've signed this player. I told Ethan, I think I signed him for the first time back when he was 16, had no game face. And that is Sandro Tonali. I thought for a debut, he was just so impressive. And especially, it's kind of hard to be impressive in the position he occupies, because although he's, you know, he is involved in the attack with those late runs into the box, a lot of his role is just, you know, maintaining possession, pressing, recycling the ball. So it can be hard to kind of notice that sometimes. And yet I thought he was just a standout performer. And it's hard to be a standout performer in a 5-1 win, by the way, because everyone is kind of a standout performer, right? But he was just phenomenal. And I even said to Ethan, I said this and then the commentator said it, which is hilarious. I was like, man, Tonali looks great in that kit. I don't know why. He just looks awesome. And then I think it was Lee Dixon. He was like, man, he wears his kit well. I love
it. And then didn't he immediately shit on Kovacic? He was like,
he did.
Kovacic wears the Man City kit and he does not look good in it or something. Yeah. Like that.
But he was kind of on to something, because I said the same thing, you know, just minutes before, just something weird. So, you know, he had this crazy debut, looks great in the kit, cost a lot of money, but it's proving to be like it. All the fans love him. So I think, I'm really excited to see his full season for sure.
I still haven't seen him smile.
He literally smiled.
He smiled in the celebration. Yeah.
Like barely. He smiled. He didn't. I mean, he like grinned. That's all I'm saying.
But, you know, my champ is kind of similar. It is similar, because I was going to say Newcastle, just because, you know, played Villa, who, you know, end of last season, they looked great. And I even touted them to do great this season, you know, to build on top of that. And they put 5 past them, which is crazy, especially with Martinez, who, you know, won the World Cup with Argentina. And then, you know, their defense just being solid from last season. So putting 5 past them is amazing. But, you know, since we kind of touched on Newcastle already, I was going to give a shout out to Edouard for being a champ, for scoring, because, you know, when you were losing all of our attack, you know, probably going to lose Elise, lost Zaha, you know, people need to step up, and it's only been a game. He might drop off after it, but, you know, he scored for us, and it made me happy, because I root for him so much.
For my chump, it's time for the chumps. When I was devising this segment, I was kind of throwing around a few ideas in my mind as to who could be the chump for this week. And then something happened today that immediately made me disregard all of those points with extreme prejudice. And this, I don't mean to overshadow y'all's chumps, because I something tells me this is not the same one, but my trump for this week is Manchester United, because they have announced today that Mason Greenwood is going to be allowed to return to the first team, which, I mean, chump is an understatement. Did they officially announce that? I thought they put out a club statement.
I thought they had a nothing club statement that was like, we're still investigating.
That's what I thought, yeah, but...
Okay, I mean, to be fair, I didn't actually read the statement, but...
I read the statement, and from what it seemed like, they want to, but they basically made a nothing statement to just gauge the reaction, which was very poor.
So the thing about this case, especially that I don't understand, by the way, is... We've had a few high-profile cases in recent weeks, like the Benjamin Mendy thing, the Thomas Partey case, the Yves Bissouma case, all these cases. The thing about those is, and by no means am I suggesting any of them are innocent or should have been left off the hook or anything, but at least there was some modicum of doubt. Like, there's some modicum of vagueness. There's not
the
a lot of...
The other thing with those, like, too, is that, like, because the laws in England are so tough, those cases especially, it's like... It's like almost everything is almost all the evidence available to the public is really hard to get. Like, it's just hard to know anything.
Right.
Not trying to say it didn't happen. I'm saying to the public specifically, it's really hard to get any information.
Exactly. And there's a lot of just, it's strictly conjecture. It's, you know, lots of, you know, just kind of, there's a lot of nothingness going around on Twitter about it. And again, not at all trying to take away from what happened. And nor do I think any of them should be exonerated if they are guilty. What I do think is that there was concrete evidence released to the public, like an actual piece of genuine evidence released on social media about Mason Greenwood, about the situation that everyone in the footballing community has seen. And yet Man United are still going to make this decision. And the ultimate thing is, even if they haven't officially announced that he's going to return to the first team, he's going to. I mean, we all know he's going to. So
The weird thing about this statement is that they were like, you know, we're trying to figure out how the club or the players and, you know, the workers feel about him returning. I'm like, what about the person who was actually involved in the incident? Yeah. How would they feel about him being out, you know, playing?
Especially because this wasn't a case where he was found not guilty, I don't think. It was one where the charges were dropped, which is very suspect in high-profile cases with celebrities, because it's like, why'd they drop the charges? You know?
Right.
Some hush money going on.
Yeah, it's such a dodgy situation. And not only, let's even take, if you look at it from purely a business perspective, even, which I don't think you should ever do, you know, obviously the moral issue is key at first, but even just looking at it from a business perspective, it's a PR disaster.
Yeah, like, I don't know what they're doing.
What's the point of doing this? Especially for a player who hasn't played in 18 months, surely it's diminishing returns. Like, is him coming back really worth all the shitstorm you're going to get for doing this? Like, not to mention all the damage that it does to your image and your brand and your, like, people's opinion of you as a club. Like, it makes no sense. Nothing about the decision makes sense at all. So,
especially with, I think over the past couple of weeks, a statement was drafted by, I don't remember the exact name of the group, but it was like a women's fans group for United. But like,
oh yeah,
an official coalition of women who are fans of United. And they made a statement like, please don't resign Mason Greenwood. And like, it just seems like that's being totally ignored.
Yeah. So anyway, Trump is a bit of an understatement, but that's my selection for Trump this week. So we'll move on to maybe something that Trump is a more appropriate word for.
Yeah, this isn't quite as heavy as a topic, but sticking with the Newcastle Village train, my Trump is Emi Martinez. Not even because he got 5 foot past him, although that is Trumpness if I ever seen it. But Emi Martinez, like, I mean, you know, I used to really like him, especially when he played for us. I had no hard feelings when he left either, but since he has left, he's like developed this persona that is just so unlikable. I find him just really classless, to be completely honest. Like, his behavior when they won the World Cup, this like random ego he's developed, like, I don't know. Like, I know you won the World Cup, but like, you play for a really good national team. You play for Aston Villa in the Prem, like, calm down, right? And it's like he's developed this weird, really annoying persona and then gets 5 foot past him. So he's my chump. That's what I'll say.
And probably should have had a red card because...
Yes, that was the other thing.
Yeah.
He had that weird, like... Or not weird. I know why he did it, because he made a stupid decision and then had to cover for himself. But he gets away with a yellow, and then, you know, he's smiling and grinning and chirping. And I'm like, dude, you were such, like you've got away with something you shouldn't have. But the like the situation itself, like, it was so...
Why were you in that situation in the first place?
Why were you there? That's just exactly terrible. Right. So, yeah, he's just been getting on my nerves lately.
That's fair. For my chump, we'll go to another goalkeeper who happens to play for yours truly. You know, weeks past, you know, there had been talk of, you know, Guaita, you know, talking about, or Roy speaking on his behalf of not being or not interested in playing for the club anymore and just refusing to train and everything. Well, fast forward, I look at Twitter to, you know, look at the team sheet before the game. I scroll down and see that Guaita, who I follow, responded saying, "Where's my name? So how can I play for Palace?" What the actual fuck are you doing? Why are you saying that you're not going to train and do all this shit and then do something like that? You know how stupid that is? That is, I saw that and thought that was the stupidest thing I ever seen in my life. So,
you know, he's realizing he's probably not going to get a move and he's trying to get the fans back on his side.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is that we've always loved him. He's always been interactive with his fans on Twitter in the sense of, like, you know, someone will be like, you know, "Oh, Guaita, my son is wearing your jersey and he did great today." And he's like, "Oh, I love it. Love Palace family." And it's all great. But I just don't understand what prompted this. Like, I'm sure if he wanted to move away, we could try and handle that. And, you know, we've got Johnston now and I think he's been fine. So I don't know why it's come to this. I don't know why he's acting like that. All the Palace fans are together that he's acting like a baby bag bitch right now. So
that's a great pick for Chubb.
Yeah. But I mean, I loved him. He's just acting ridiculous right now. Sorry, Vicente, but you're acting chump-like right now.
Well, that concludes chump. I can't even say the segment right. Champs and chumps. Chumps and champs. Chump charity. Whichever version of that you like. Okay, let's dive straight in. We have a few news items to cover. First of all, really just one news item that I want to talk about because one of the most interesting things that happened this week was the bidding war that sort of came out of nowhere, this proposed deadline for Moises Caicedo that Brighton imposed. We saw the figures start to get ridiculously high. I believe on Saturday night it was reported, or maybe it was Friday night, I can't remember, but it was reported that, you know, Liverpool had it was a done deal. He was going to Liverpool, and then he decides that he wants to go to London. He wants to play for Chelsea. He's been a Chelsea fan since he was young. So Chelsea have agreed the deal, announced it. It's all official for a British record transfer fee of 115 million Great British pounds.
It's crazy to think he was our cheaper alternative to Declan Rice.
And he ended up being more expensive in the long run, which with fewer appearances in the Premier League. So you could say he's, you know, less Premier League proven and all those, you know, adages that people say about midfielders, especially, I feel like. But I've got a big time question for Reese, and I did prepare him for this question as well, so not to completely blindside him, but what qualities does Moises Caicedo have that would prompt Chelsea to pay such a stupendous price?
So the main thing I looked at when I was doing some research for this was directly comparing their two current starters that started their first game this past weekend to Caicedo, because they played a midfield two in their opening game of Gallagher and Enzo Fernandez. And to be fair, I compared last season's stats, so there was more to pull from. Granted, Enzo still only had half a season to Caicedo's. However, I think the numbers kind of speak for themselves. The first one I wanted to point out, and the main one, is that they're getting some defensive soundness, because currently they don't have it. I don't think Enzo is as good in defense as people think he is. For reference, last season, although only half a season, Enzo only had 71 tackles with a 56% success rate. Now, Those numbers are with half a season. With a full season, Gallagher had 58 tackles, so less tackles, and a 67% success. So less tackles than Enzo, higher success rate, but not really that by that much. Comparatively, Caicedo, with 116 tackles last season, with an 80% percentage, complete percentage. So not only is he registering way more tackles, even with the higher amount, he's has a considerably higher tackle success percentage. So that's just an indicator. He is going to perform way better, in especially if they're going to stick with this double double pivot with only two midfielders, which may not end up happening. They may swap to three now that they're bringing in Lavia, but that's a whole other thing. The other thing I looked at three. So the next one was passes. Passes, Gallagher gets completely blown out of the water. Their percentages are all pretty similar. So for Caicedo, Gallagher, and Enzo, respectively, it's 80, 84, 89, with Enzo having the highest and Caicedo actually having the lowest, although it's at 80%. So it's pretty negligible. The numbers, though, Caicedo with 1,902, Enzo with 1,204, Gallagher with 746. And I know it could be said Gallagher played less games than Caicedo, I believe. So just looking at the raw numbers, Gallagher's the loser there. Then we look at, I pulled shots, and for reference, I also have on target and blocked, because only saying which ones were on target's a little misleading. I got this from InfoGoal, by the way. Only saying what's on target's a little misleading because it doesn't account for blocked shots. Because it's not like, oh, he had this many on target, the rest were off target. It's like he had this many on target, this many off target, this many blocked. So Caicedo and Gallagher in terms of shots are actually extremely comparable. It's 23 to 23. Gallagher slightly more shots on target with 11 to 7, but Caicedo with more blocked, 12 to 9. So it's very comparable numbers there. Enzo being the loser in shots. So I think in the end, you know, shots pretty comparable across the board. Passing, Gallagher's the loser there. Tackles, Gallagher's the loser there. With, more importantly, Caicedo being the supreme winner in tackles. So I think it's a very long-winded way of saying that they're getting some defensive presence in the midfield, because they just currently don't really have that.
The other thing I would say about especially Caicedo's lower pass completion rate as well, not that it's a huge amount lower, but when you start getting to as high volume of passing as they have, you can start to differentiate by a few percentage points a little bit more. I think the thing about Enzo is his role is very predominantly to be a volume passer. I mean, he's a recycler, right, by nature. And Caicedo is too, to some measure, but he's also someone who's more willing to play those line-breaking passes. And I think that is something that brings his, you know, completion rate down. But in terms of his actual value created to the team, it balances out. So I think he complements Enzo really well, for one thing. Whether or not the pair of them together are worth $220 million, that's for you to decide. But they do complement each other really well. So we'll have to see how that pairing, maybe trio if we add Lavia to the mix, as you said, looks going forward.
I got to say, this deal is in Chelsea as well, are completely rooting my hopes and dreams. Because not only are Chelsea getting Elise for a stupid amount, but them signing Caicedo and tempting him away from Liverpool is now getting Liverpool to look at Doucouré, and I can't have anything anymore. So this is like, I'm the odd factor here, and we're getting like a stray bullet.
Surely you don't sell Doucouré.
I hope we don't, but our board just is signed, stupid.
And he probably doesn't have a release clause.
I don't think he does, but our board is stupid.
Because I don't really think y'all want to sell Elise. He just has a release clause.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to punch a man while he's down either, but Brighton also are the winners. The winners of this deal are Brighton. Let's make no bones about it. Because not only did they receive $115 million for Caicedo, $111 million of that is profit because they signed him for $4 million. And,
you know, actually, another winner from this is Caicedo's original club, because I think they get like $20 million in residuals from Ceylon or something like that, which is
okay.
Like,
so it's not all a lot, for Brighton, then
a lot more than
what they actually received for him the first time.
Yeah, they're. I think they're building. I read that they're building a new training facility with the money and naming it after Caicedo.
I mean that's kind of cool.
Yeah,
I think it's cool. That's a cool touch.
I did see a funny tweet, and it was like Brighton. It was like at a transfer account. And it was like Brighton have made a bid that was rejected, and someone quote tweeted it at the club that was receiving the bid and was like, "They got all that money, like get them."
yeah.
It was funny though.
That concludes the segment. So we'll move on to the meat and potatoes of the show, which is, of course, discussing all the action at the weekend. Now, I want to start in chronological order, as we usually do with Arsenal. Of course, we're not going to talk about every game. We're going to move through some of the ones that are less interesting to our untrained eyes, I suppose. So we're going to start with Arsenal. Now, Reese, I actually lied because we're going to start with Forest. I'm going to ask you quickly about, especially considering how high you were on them in your predictions and, you know, how much you were looking forward to seeing their sophomore season success, as you put it. Does this performance fill you with hope, and especially towards the end of the performance as well?
The end, definitely. I thought the beginning they were pretty weak, although they did have one really good chance that they just failed to take. So I think they had a game plan that just kind of dissolved because of a missed chance. But yeah, I thought they looked pretty organized. I think as well, this tactic in this game is set up for Arsenal, right? They are set up for a team that's going to hold possession the whole game. And so you don't get to see a lot of their qualities. But I think, you know, facing similar opposition, that's not going to be quite as an issue. So, but I mean, just seeing some tactics on display is better than last year, I think, because I was saying in our preseason discussion, that last season they just had so many players coming in and out of the team that like tactics wasn't really even in the question, because you just can't implement something with so many players changing. So I think seeing the team, you know, unified in what they're doing and the way, you know, they're setting up is good for sure. I think it might look a little better than it should have been, because, you know, had they taken their first chance, like I said, I think they would have done well. They didn't, though. And then, you know, we probably should have scored more than two, just considering the state of the game and how it went. But, you know, we didn't either. So then we come to the end of the game. They get back in it, kind of make it competitive towards the end. But, yeah, I would say I'm still hopeful about where they're going to go in their season.
To add to that, you know, I thought they also had that chance at the beginning, which was unfortunate not to take. For a good chunk of the game, I thought, you know, the gambit of having Brendan Johnson up front and try and like get past the defenders on the break was not working. But then again, Arsenal are a great team. They'll probably be up there this season, or will be up there this season. So we'll see when they go up against player or against teams that are in their around their area. I was really impressed with Elanga when he came on. I mean,
yeah,
I thought it was a decent signing. I didn't think he was going to be amazing, but you know, just from the 10 minutes that he was on, I thought, you know, that he can be a danger man for them going forward. So I might have been harsh having them in the last relegation spot, but you know, we'll see. It's only been one game. You can speak a lot of teams on that.
All right, Reese, take it away.
I have just a couple notes written down for Arsenal. I think there was a few weird things with the team that kind of contributed to some lack of analysis. But the first thing to note, the possession gambit is back. Nothing has changed in that front. If anything, it's gotten better. And I know it's against Forest, but we've added a lot of players to the squad that are just good at retaining possession. And it shows in this game, we had almost 80% possession. It was 70. The final tally was 78.3, which is just ridiculous numbers. Again, high possession leads to more shots, 15 shots to six. I wrote down a question, why so competitive at the end, you know, in response to those numbers. My answer I came up with was, and I'll just read this to you verbatim, party at right back is weird. I'll talk about that first. I think that was more of out of necessity because, it's necessity tactically, I should say. Zinchenko obviously is still out. He should be back within a week or two, which meant our right back, Urien Timber, had to play left back in this game. And then I think Arteta really wants that, you know, inverted fullback coming into midfield, and Partey can play right back. So he opted to go with Partey there instead of Ben White so that he could have that midfield presence. Although I think I'm not sure how I feel about both fullbacks playing inverted. I think it leaves us really open on the counter, which is what we saw in this game. I much more preferred when Zinchenko would go inverted and then Ben White would kind of slot in as a third center back for those moments. Or, you know, if Ben White was pushing up, then someone would drop back and cover. I think that a little bit of defensive coverage is more important than having both fullbacks coming inverted. The other thing, I just talked about Urien Timber, ACL injury in the first game, which we talked about injuries. I said he was our injury cover, and now he is torn his ACL and is out for 7 months. So really unlucky for him, especially after what I thought was a great preseason and really good start to the Prem until he got injured. So that's a really big bummer, and it's definitely worrying for sure, because he was someone I was counting as coverage in the defense for both right back and center back, and now we are down. I think I saw a tweet. It was, we are one more or two more injuries away from Rob Holding starting once again. So, and you know I love Rob Holding, but he's just not quite good enough for a full season campaign when we're trying to win the title. The next point I have was didn't kill the game. I kind of already talked about that. We had so much possession, so many shots, weren't really able to kill the game. I think part of that is just, you know, maybe start of season jitters. I don't know. I think after the Saka goal, it was quenched, because Saka scores an absolute worldie in the opening game of the season, starting the season how he ended last. And it's just kind of, it's like a statement goal. It's like, well, you know, even if our attack's not going to score, I'm still here, right? And I'm the man, I'm the guy. So I think that kind of eased the nerves, and I'm hoping that, you know, he's going to carry that into the next few games. I think Nketiah getting on the score sheet is also huge, because he's going to have to do a job for Jesus while he's out.
I was a little surprised to see him start, actually, especially considering Havertz played up top in preseason.
I was a little surprised as well, but Arteta is just, he's always been someone who appreciates working hard. And he said, actually, someone asked him about that after the game. He said, if you had seen how Nketiah trained the week leading up, you would think I was stupid if I hadn't started him. I think that's almost exactly what he said, something along those lines. So he just trained. He works really hard. And I, you know, it shows, because when he had to come in last season for Jesus, goals scored versus games started was actually a really good return for Nketiah. And, you know, now we're starting off the season, gets a goal in his first game. So I think that's pretty big. But yeah, I think the party at right back gambit, I don't really like it. I think maybe it can last one more game before we need to trash it. Just go back to Ben White. Although I suspect it will probably happen, and he may even play left back next game, because Zinchenko's probably still going to be out, and Arteta has shown to favor sometimes even, you know, the off, what's it called? The, when you have your right-footed player on the left side, I don't even remember.
Yeah, I can't even remember what it's called.
Having a right-footed player at left back, he's done a couple times with Tomiyasu, although, you know, he's kind of, he can use both feet. But I kind of suspect that until Zinchenko is back, Partey will start at left back. I just have a feeling. I think he will opt for that instead of Tomiyasu. Maybe Tierney will play. I love it. I thought he had a great preseason, but it looks like we're trying to sell him. So I don't think he wants to give him that hope of staying when he's like really trying to get him out the door. But who knows? Maybe Tierney starts. Maybe Tomiyasu starts. I don't really know at this point. But I thought Partey being at right back is kind of an indicator that he might be just the preferred option purely because of that inverted fullback thing. So I would like that to change. Don't really think it will until Sinchenko goes back from injury. I think that's all I have. I just talked a bunch, but
I did have one thing I wanted to ask. Y'all announced the signing of Raya either today or yesterday. When do you, or how do you think this is going to be with Ramsdale? Do you think one's going to start over the other? Or?
Well, my initial thought was that he's just competition for Ramsdale, but that they were both really good. And then, according to Tim Howard, he knows somebody. He has sources, and Raya is being signed to start over him, which I'm not completely shocked by. In terms of metrics, they were very close. Raya sometimes even beating out Ramsdale last year. Raya also much more confident with his feet. So I think get he just fit maybe fits Arteta's plans better, but we'll see, right? I do think, you know, this is competition. So if Arteta decides, you know, maybe Ramsdale gets one more game before I swap him out, Ramsdale, we could see some kind of masterclass in his next game or the game after, just because, you know, he's got a fire under him now. He's got a reason. Because before, right, it's like Ramsdale and Matt Turner, which I love Matt Turner, but I mean, we even saw in this game, right? I mean,
he's great. Shout out to Matt Turner.
Yeah, he's great, but definitely not the quality to start for us, right? So I think both Raya and Ramsdale are quality to start for us. So it just kind of elevates them. The joke floating around Twitter is that as soon as we announced that we were in for Raya, Ramsdale saved two penalties in the preseason, which he is terrible at penalties. So that's kind of the joke, but it's kind of real too, right?
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, and maybe you might have to tell me that there's too small of a sample size and you won't be able to really answer this question yet, but as you know, I was quite critical of the Kai Havertz signing, as I think a lot of banter merchants were on Twitter, which I consider myself one, a banter merchant. But I'm interested to know if and how he is similar in the advanced eight role to Xhaka, and if you've noticed anything at this time that differentiates him, which, you know, as I said, it's a very small sample size, so
yeah,
I understand that. But
there was one moment in the game where it was this beautiful link-up play between Havertz and Odegaard, just playing 1-2s after 1-2 and making runs into the box. And the difference between Xhaka and Havertz that I can notice so far is that Havertz is just slightly more precise, I feel like. The other thing is he has an extra quality in his height, which Xhaka didn't have. He's not short, but Kai Havertz has got quite a few inches on him. And that's just another added depth we can have, especially in the midfield, right? Now we can try and bypass midfield, just boot it long. Havertz is making a run. I think in this first game, it was a little hard to tell because I think he was having to do some covering. I think the whole midfield was having to do some covering because both the Timber injury late on in the 50th minute and Partey at right back. I think the midfield was having some extra duties, but yeah, there was that one specific moment where I was like, yeah, this is why we signed him.
Okay. Good stuff. All right. I'm going to pass the buck on to Ethan now, as that's the next game in our little chronological time frame here. Of course, Crystal Palace earning a 1-0 win and a clean sheet on opening day, which I'm sure you're pleased about the result, but are you pleased about the performance? That's the question.
You know, I am actually very happy with the 3 points, just because, you know, obviously I didn't expect Sheffield United to do that well this season, but, you know, just get promoted. Usually, you know, it's a home game for them as well. Usually it's inspiring for them. I mean, you know, I've seen it happen before where a promoted team will beat my team specifically. You know, it's happened a few times, but yeah, I was actually somewhat impressed with what we did. I think, you know, obviously the players who had to step up for the players not involved, like, you know, Zaha obviously left and Olise still injured, probably going to leave. They stepped up, you know, Eze looked great like always. Edouard got the goal. I think, you know, with maybe a few more incomings and, you know, players getting back from injury, they will start looking good. Especially the defense was good, as well as the midfield. You know, one signing that I was not, you know, expecting to be as vital as he has been is Jefferson Lerma. And he was probably the leader in that midfield this game. You know, he's got that fire in him and, you know, obviously dominated their midfield. Just very happy with Edouard. You know, it is hard to tell how we're going to do this season, though, because I'll say it again, it's only been one game. But, you know, like I said, I haven't been too confident in Sheffield United. And you can kind of tell with how they were playing, because, like, you know, just getting used to the quality that the Premier League has again. And I do think they work hard, but it's just like, you know, do they have the right quality to put in these good performances? So I think players like Ozula, who was up front, was like really, really good looking, you know, face wise, but not just playing. I thought he had a lot of pace on him compared to the rest of the team. And I think once he works out, you know, ball control and stuff like that, I think, you know, he'll be a great player for them. But yeah, I'm pretty happy with how he performed, and it's good to go on. I know a hard game next with Arsenal coming up, so it'll be a it'll be like a crash dummy test, and you know, immediately going like 75 and then hitting the brakes immediately. But
yeah,
well, that'll be a good game for Arsenal probably, but it'll be interesting to see how we perform against them. But I think the one thing I really took from this game was the fact that Roy Hodgson got that dog in him, and he was ready to die on that field for the badge after that little incident with who was it, Lowe, Gage?
Max Lowe, yeah, Max Lowe.
Max Lowe gave Roy a little bit of a push on the stomach, and Roy was about to go 15 rounds with that man. So it's good to know that.
Go ahead. Sorry, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, someone tweeted that Roy's in his villain era, like like calling out the our management, or not management, but like our CEO and
the board,
the higher ups, yeah, the board, calling them out for not signing players and, you know, just being more attacking. And I'm here for it, you know, even if it's an attack at an actual player physically. So
I was telling Ethan when it happened, I was like, you know, Roy should be mad. Like, you can't be pushing him over. He's 80 million years old. He's going to crumble to dust.
Yeah. So
I'm just saying, if I was a Palace fan and I saw 78-year-old Roy Hodgson getting fired up on an opposing left back in a game against Sheffield United, I would be so fired up. I'm just going to say that.
Reese could tell you. I was.
I would be on the Roy train.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like an old Roy thing to do would be like, oh, my bad, you know. But yeah, I was pumped because it seems like Roy's really like digging in and is like,
sick of the bullshit, man.
He's ready to fight for it. And someone said, you know, with all of the links for our players, you know, someone was like, fuck it, we're gonna do Premier League on hard difficulty, or the most difficult difficulty possible. So I think that Roy recognizes that, and you know, he's gonna work harder tactical wise and maybe get a few more signings in. But and other than that, you know, we put the ball in the back of the net a few times. It had just been offside, so I think, you know, we definitely could have won this game by a few more goals, but I'll happily take the win however they come.
There was something I noticed that I wanted to ask you about, was that I thought Eze had a really good game, but I also thought there was times where it looked like maybe this is just something that comes with time, but the spotlight is on him now, right? Because Olise is injured, probably leaving. Zaha is gone, so he's the guy. There was times where it kind of looked like he was thinking that, like, there'd be moments where it's like decision moments where it's like, I can either pass or I can shoot. And then it looked like his internal monologue was like, well, I need to do it by myself because I'm the guy. I'm the guy now. Is that something that just comes with time, or is that going to be something that's, you know, that you think is maybe reoccurring, or maybe you didn't even notice it. Maybe I'm just tripping, but
no, I did notice it too. Cause I definitely, you know, and he's shot the ball plenty of times in previous seasons, but he definitely seems like he's, you know, trying to step up a little bit. There was a few shots that he took that I was like, you know, if he had picked up a better shot, then, you know, that probably would have gone in. But I'm glad he's trying. You know, it's definitely something that we've needed to improve on from past seasons is that we just need to shoot more. But I think, you know, with players like, you know, forget Olise, he's only been here for like a season or two, but Zaha has just been in our system for so long that we're so used to just dipping the ball to him and let him work his magic. So it's definitely going to be a change. It's something, you know, as sad as it's been, you know, literally right when Zaha left, I was like watching all of his old goals and like getting emotional and going through it. I'm sure Gage has been going through it as well with Kane, but you know, it'll be interesting to see how we do without him. And I mean, it'll open up maybe some opportunities for other players to shine. So you know, the players are going to have to deal with that. And I think they're ready and able.
We will move on from Palace. Let's actually talk. We don't have to talk a whole lot about this game because we talked a good amount of it about it in the Champs and Chumps section, but there are a few points I want to bring up. The next game, of course, that I'm talking about is the Newcastle 5-1 destruction of Aston Villa, which is, you know, putting it mildly, I think it was a complete dismantling. One of the points that I wanted to bring up, well, firstly, is to confess to Reese that he was correct about Newcastle's free-flowing style and the fact that they are not serial time wasters as I once considered them to be. In fact, they only had 4 added minutes at the end of this game, if I'm right in saying so. With the new rules, that's an impressive feat considering they, you know, seem to be focused on scoring more than they were on wasting time. So fair enough. I hold my hands up and confess to being wrong and Reese to being right. So the other thing I wanted to mention was the fact that I was surprised by how advanced Tonali's role was in the team, like how far up the pitch he was playing. And
yeah,
the reason I say that is because whenever Spurs played Milan in the round of 16 in the Champions League last season, he was actually the deepest midfielder on the pitch at all times, pretty much. And I think that was not necessarily the case. I think he was in advanced areas a lot. I think Bruno was deeper than him a lot. Bruno, of course, you know, not Bruno Guimaraes, I should clarify, not that it would be any other Bruno. I don't know why I felt the need to clarify, but he is the sort of deep-lying playmaker mold. But it was surprising to me that Tonali took such an attacking role.
Yeah, I mean, he scored, and then he almost scored immediately after that, too. So
I know.
It was kind of, that would have been crazy.
I was popping off.
Yeah, I would have been in the bin, dude, after talking shit about him in the predictions, and he scores twice in 7 minutes. But yeah, I'm already in the bin.
Yeah. I think, you know, part of that, because he's a great tackler, and we saw that at moments in this game. And we did see spells where, you know, he would be the deepest lying midfielder. But like you said, he'd get up a lot. And I think part of that is because Newcastle recognizes that, yeah, you're a great tackler, but he is a phenomenal passer. Like, unbelievably accurate is the specific word I want to use, because not only like pings, but, you know, it seems like everything is just perfectly weighted and goes right to the player's feet. The other thing about it is that he just seems like he has really good game sense. So he knows when it would be good to make a deep run make a late run into the box. I think that was kind of his trademark in this game, was those late runs. Which, you know, he's coming in, he's replacing Joe Willock, who has been great at Newcastle. But Tonali just kind of blew him out of the water, and they were playing similar roles. Joe Willock kind of, you know, making those late runs into the box. Tonali's kind of taken that over and then also added defensive stability.
And I felt like every time I looked up and Newcastle were in possession, he was making a combination with another player. Like, he's just constantly combining, linking the play, making quick 1-2s, just involved in the play at all times. And I think that's one of the most impressive things about his performance as well. So I may yet eat my words about Newcastle this season. There's 37 games to go, so don't get on your high horse just quite yet, but it's not looking good for my predictions. Something else I wanted to point out about Newcastle is I am kind of wondering if there is a similarity in approach with Howe's Newcastle to Klopp's Liverpool. And the reason I'm going to say this is because, for one thing, the midfield is designed almost exactly the same. You have a trio of relatively box-to-box-esque players who are not necessarily designed to be creative. They are creative from time to time, but their distinct role is not necessarily to be creative. It's more to be industrious, you know, get up and down the pitch, play balls into lanes, cut out passes, that kind of thing. And a lot of their creativity comes from an emphasis on deep crosses from the fullbacks, which is something, of course, Liverpool is famous for. So, of course, Kieran Trippier is I think he led the league last season in crosses. And then they've signed Livramento as well, who can play on both the left and the right. He's someone else who will focus a lot. I mean, he's one of the high volume crossers in the Premier League last season. So something else I noticed. And then Isak kind of bears some familiarities to Firmino, I think, because he's a tall striker who kind of drops off and plays some hold up style, false nine role, likes to dribble, likes to get on the ball, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I just have to say I was noticing some similarities between Klopp's Liverpool and Howe's Newcastle.
I think in some ways this Newcastle side is even better too. I think their midfield is probably a little bit more developed than Klopp's best midfield was. I think also Isak, I think I'd probably take him over Firmino. I think they do possess a lot of the same qualities. They're both tall. They're both really good with their feet despite that. However, something I noticed from Isak that you don't always notice from Firmino is that he found himself in behind quite a lot. So he's making runs in behind, like solo runs. He's very quick as well. Yeah, I think in some ways they're slightly more developed. And then, you know, in some other ways they're not quite as well. You know, I think you'd much rather have Andy Robertson than Dan Byrne. Although he's doing a job. He's playing
well. He is doing a job.
You know, the one thing that I kind of stuck for me, because, you know, obviously a bunch of these players like Ezak and Callum Wilson coming off the bench and scoring are, you know, usual contributors to the squad. But Anthony Gordon actually surprised me. I thought he looked good.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Assist for Tonali's goal.
I think a lot of people are kind of expecting Anthony Gordon or Anthony Gordon. Is it Anthony or Anthony?
I've heard both.
Both. I don't know.
They're kind of expecting Gordon to swap out with Harvey Barnes, and they're going to be in competition. But I could see a world where they play together and Almiron is the one who's dropped, because I think I like Almiron a lot, but I think definitely Harvey Barnes has got to start, and Anthony Gordon, he has a really high ceiling, that it may be worth dropping Almiron and just forcing Gordon to play.
Well, and Barnes is so direct that he can play on either side. I mean, he plays so narrow that it doesn't necessarily matter what side he plays on.
I expect him to play on the left, because him cutting in from the right in this team is just so lethal. We saw him with that trademark finish in this game. And Gordon, it was his cross that got the assist, and it was with his weak foot. So I think maybe sticking him on the right side, having him as more of a crosser, especially in conjunction with Trippier, because he's their main fullback who's crossing. I think having, you know, their right side very cross heavy, their left side very, you know, drive into the box, try and get one-on-ones, it could be interesting.
All right. I believe it is my time to shine, as they say in the showbiz. It's time to talk about Ange Postecoglou's debut at Spurs, a 2-2 draw at Brentford, which, to tell you the truth, is a passable result, I think, on paper, given the circumstances. I mean, first of all, it's a brand new manager, complete 180 in terms of system and style. Kane leaves 2 days before the game, which obviously is going to define this new era. It's the post-Kane, post-Ecoglou Spurs. And, you know, Brentford as well are sort of a perfect tactical antidote to the Postecoglou system as well, because of the high line, and Brentford are, at this point, maybe the best counterattacking team in the league. I mean, they're one of the only direct counterattacking teams left, so I think they might be the best counterattacking team in the league. So they're a great antidote to Spurs as far as tactics is concerned. Minimal training time for Van de Ven as well, who we brought in for an expensive fee. He was fine, but I just think it's going to take him time to learn the system and partner with Romero and the other defenders as well. And then not only that, but I mean, Brentford are a good side. It's tough to go away to the Brentford Community Stadium. So I think all things considered, I'm quite happy with a 2-2 draw. Yeah, like Ethan, I spent the weekend lamenting the departure of my favorite ever athlete from my beloved club, which, you know, I think is something that whenever it was kind of building up, I spent the whole summer preparing myself for it. And then you're never ready for it when you wake up the morning of and see him in the kit. And
I've had almost a decade to prepare for it, and I still wasn't ready.
Yeah. I mean, people have been talking about Kane leaving Spurs for almost as long. So, you know, I should have been ready for it. But what really got me was the video that he put out afterwards, which it was probably some prepared nonsense by a PR agent, but you could tell. I mean, he was getting slightly emotional talking to the Spurs fans and, you know, just saying how much his time meant at the club. And that is what really got me whenever that came out. So, yeah, of course, I have no hard feelings at all. I completely understand why he left. I'm glad it was to Bayern and not to a Premier League rival. So I get it, but it's still, I mean, I'm not angry or like disappointed or anything. I'm just sad. Like, I'm just sad that it didn't work out and that he didn't win stuff with Spurs. But either way, the new era does look bright. I mean, we had lots of bright spots in this game. I thought the midfield looked very promising. Bissouma, I thought, was a great press-resistant midfielder. There were several moments in the game where he looked like Moussa Dembele. I mean, just gliding through the midfield, sliding past pressers. Great skills, great touch. James Maddison had both assists for Spurs in the game, and I thought his delivery is just something that we haven't had since Eriksen left. I think that's such a key portion of the team that we've been missing for so long. So, yeah, they really impressed me. And, you know, Reese, you talked about how you weren't a huge proponent of the idea of both fullbacks being inverted. because it leaves so much space in behind, and it does. But I think Spurs have taken to that system, quite well, because I mean, the second goal came from Emerson Royale being on the left side of the edge of the box. You know, that's the right back in a, popping up in a creative area. And Udogie, of course, was involved a lot as well, quite high up the pitch, which is how he played for Udinese. So,
yeah. I can definitely imagine it working better when the players doing it are traditional fullbacks instead of traditional midfielders playing fullback, you know, because they might be a little better at recovering.
Right. So those were the standouts. There are a few immediate concerns about the team as well. I think in spite of all the waxing pathetic that Spurs fans have done in recent months about the defense, they actually were mostly fine, including when Davinson Sanchez came on and played the majority of the game. Like, I thought they were mostly pretty fine. There were a few, you know, obviously the goals. The penalty was a little soft, but it is probably a foul. But and then Emerson Royale got cooked a few times on his side, and that led to Brentford's second goal. But the biggest concern for me actually is the fact that the front three just does not look like they have their head screwed on straight. I think there was a lot of missed link-up opportunities, a lot of miscommunications. Just, it looks like they've never played together, which honestly, I'm not sure this combination of players has. I mean, I'm sure they have at some point, but...
Yeah, I think Kane was a lot of the glue in your attack as well.
Yeah.
Especially with Son, I think. Because, I mean, you just look at their numbers. They have, like, don't they have the record for most combined goals for a pair?
Yeah.
So it's like, and I think Son's a good player, and he's performed well when Kane's, like, been injured before. But I think him without... Son in the world without Kane, which sounds... super depressing. The world without Kane. Son in the world without Kane.
He is still alive.
Really weird. Yes. I think he's going to either have to adapt very quickly or he's going to find himself dropped, which is crazy because he is Yell's new captain. So
new club captain, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think is an indicator of what Postecoglou wants. I don't think he'd make him captain if he didn't think I'm going to play him a lot. But it's just something to think about for sure.
I would personally be interested to see if at some point this season, especially given the fact that Richarlison is not impressing me so far, if Son doesn't get moved up top, I think playing Son centrally actually makes a good amount of sense. Because
I mean, when we've seen Son without Kane, he was always playing striker.
Right. And I think he has that ability to run in behind, which is something that, you know, the team is going to look for, especially with the likes of Bissouma, who's going to be looking for that line-breaking pass, the likes of Bentancur when he gets back, who's going to be there, and Madison, of course, has the craziest delivery on earth. So, yeah, I think that could be a possible avenue. The other thing that concerns me about that a little bit, at least the front three, is I think Dan Kulusevski is a fantastic technical player. I don't think he suits the system because he plays on the right. His traditional angle is always to cut in and try to bend one with his left, whether that be a cross or a shot. Whereas Postecoglou really depends on those wingers for a lot of the width because those fullbacks are so narrow and inverted. And I think you're going to see pretty quickly, I would imagine, Manor Solomon probably either take that spot for good or start getting subbed on quite early. I mean, he didn't make an appearance in this game, but I would imagine you'll see him in some capacity against Man United because I think he's much more of the archetypical Postecoglou winger who sticks to the sideline, loves to drill in a cross, is a tricky dribbler, which Kulusevski is a lot of things, but he's not a tricky dribbler. So I think Solomon actually profiles quite a bit better to the system than Kulusevski does.
I have a quick question about Brentford.
Sure.
What were your thoughts of Brentford without Tony? Because that's another life without striker that they're going to have to deal with for a large portion of the season.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I kind of think they were just business as usual. I think they're a team that is confident enough in their system and has been a well-oiled machine for long enough last season that I don't foresee it. It's obviously going to be a negative. I mean, they would much rather have him than not, right? But I think their system is well-oiled enough that I could totally foresee it being productive even without him. I'm not worried about them, I'll tell you that. I think Mbomo is just such a great counterattacker. I mean, he might even be a better counterattacker than Tony. And so if they're going to do this, you know, the more and more teams that we see that are going to develop a possession style, I mean, I think Chelsea are probably going to trend in that direction. Spurs are trending in that direction. Arsenal, City, we know about them. Liverpool, kind of, you know, I think the more and more teams that try to shoot for that, actually the more successful Brentford will be, because they're going to be able to catch those teams out. And I think Mbomo is going to be a real star this season, especially without Tony. So,
yeah, I had one thing about, you know, this could be brief, but I know it's changed, the opinion of him changed over the seasons, but what do you think of Royale now?
Cult hero Emerson Royale, who's on pace to break Holland's record for 1 year.
Yeah.
You know, I think he won back the hearts of a lot of Spurs fans, myself included, last season with his performances. I don't love him in the system. I think he is someone who generally, Reese was mentioning that conventional fullbacks are a lot better at recovering, but actually I think Emerson is someone who's kind of, his conventional position is as a deep lying fullback, or not, I mean, that's not really a thing, but like a fullback who doesn't go forward quite as often as he's going to be asked to. So it's a square peg in a round hole, but I also think that's true of Pedro Porro, because he is just reckless abandon.
He kind of has the opposite issue. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a round peg in a square hole. Like it's the exact opposite, because yeah. So to answer your question, I love the work ethic. I love the passion. I love the fact that he's striking the ball and it's not going into orbit, which is a change from last season. Yeah. But I do still think that right back is an area that Spurs need to improve on, which I think I have stated since Kyle Walker left in 2017. So The big fixture of the weekend, as far as the marquee matchup is concerned, was Chelsea versus Liverpool, the new era, well, the Moises Caicedo derby, as we should start to call it now, as they faced off to try to earn his signature. But I have a key question about this game before we begin, and that is, what did we make of SpongeBob?
I thought he looked fine.
Also thought he looked fine. The main thing I had issues with was their midfield as a whole, not specifically SpongeBob. You mentioned Chelsea were trending towards possession, and they absolutely were in this game too. It was almost 65% possession in this game. I think a large part of that is because of Liverpool's midfield, which is strange because they outnumbered them, right? Chelsea played with two. But in my notes, I have written SpongeBob, Gakpo, McAllister. That was their midfield three. And then I have an arrow, Trent coming into midfield, inverted fullback cannot be the only DM. I think when you are playing with inverted fullbacks, which everyone is doing now, you have to have a DM in the side, because you are just losing so much defensive capabilities, but also it just becomes weird. I just think it's weird if you play inverted fullbacks without a DM. So this midfield of SpongeBob, Gakpo, and McAllister with Trent coming in from fullback is just odd. They have, I say this knowing they have signed a DM today, Watari Endo, but also like literally who is that? So I don't know what they're going to do. They need a DM so bad, and they bought one, but like literally have they really?
Maybe Endo will keep them off the backup. Maybe that'll be the Endo them chasing.
Yeah.
Cheick Doucouré.
I don't really think so, considering I think he's like 30 something. I think he's like 30.
He's 30. Yeah.
And literally, who is he? Right. They've signed some. I don't want to sound like I'm just crapping on Endo. I just generally don't know who he is. Which he cannot be your only DM at the club.
Well, he definitely watches the podcast, and I was going to knock him
out. Yeah, exactly.
We'll have him on to defend himself if need be.
Those were my immediate midfield thoughts, not just about SpongeBob, but as Liverpool's midfield.
Yeah. The SpongeBob question was a little bit tongue in cheek, but
they need a DM in there so bad.
Yeah, I did think he had a nice run there at like the beginning. He was like maneuvering in and out of the defenders and almost got a shot. I think someone went in and stole his shot, but You know, I thought he looked fine. You know, they just have to hold it down, like Reese said.
Well, one thing that surprised me, actually, especially from someone who watched his tenure at Spurs for a long time, is I was surprised that Judas Iscariot elected to go with a back three in this game. I think I was really expecting him to revert to the classic Pochettino thing of 4-2-3-1. And I sort of wonder if... What I'm going to say is, how likely is it that they switch? We talked about it earlier, but how likely is it that they switch to a three with the addition of Lavia?
I think 100%. I was just going to say that. Like, I think the back three is purely because they do not have enough midfielders that they are confident in. Because it was Gallagher, Enzo. Who else do they have? I couldn't even tell you.
On the bench, Ugochukwu, who's someone that they brought in from the French league, and I couldn't tell you much about.
Yeah.
And Andre Santos, who plays a little bit of a different, I mean, he's more forward thinking than yeah. perhaps they would like. So,
so I think with Lavia, they for sure go 4-3-3, but
yeah,
or 4-2, yeah. whatever you said, three in the midfield anyway.
And one thing that I thought was interesting, or not necessarily interesting, but there were elements of youth permeating throughout Chelsea's team, right? I mean, you have Gallagher, for one thing, who's got plenty of Premier League experience. Levi Colwill, who has a good amount, but is still quite young and new to the Chelsea team at the very least. And then Carney Chukwuemeka, who makes his first Premier League start for Chelsea, along with Nico Jackson up top. So lots of youth. And I think you could tell, I think, in a lot of ways, because there is a lot of that desire to be inventive and to be brave and creative that comes from the youth. But at the same time, there is a lot of, I want to say uncertainty, but I don't necessarily know if that's the right word, like inexperience. You can tell there's elements of inexperience in the game. And I think bringing in some signings will obviously help with that. But I do wonder how much Pochettino's going to, what's that?
It's hilarious to say about Chelsea.
Yeah, I
get what you mean, but it's hilarious.
No, I mean, it is. It's just, it's like, I'm not saying they should sign more players, but they're going to sign more players. So that might help with the inexperience.
They have signed more players.
Right. But then they're going to bring in Lavia, who's played a full season, sure, but he's 19. So he's still young.
Enzo's 21.
Very youthful. Very youthful. I mean, Enzo's, what, 22? So
I think actually Gallagher is the oldest midfielder.
He very well might be, because Ugochukwu is not too old either. So yeah, I mean, it's a very young team. And I mean, Mudryk, I'm just looking. Mudryk, Motsen, Gusto, Madueke, they're all under 25. So
I sent y'all a tweet. The craziest trash nickname that we've got, the secret to SpongeBob with Ukraine Bolt.
For Mudryk.
Yeah. Because that's all he can do, supposedly, is just run.
His Bolt. Yeah.
It's funny that it's all these young players and then just Thiago Silva, who's like a million.
He is a
million. And Raheem Sterling, who feels like he should be a million.
Yeah.
Because he's been around for so long.
Yeah.
So let's bring that section of the podcast to an end. We will, of course, be back next week to talk more games. We will be sure to rotate the teams around a little bit so that we cover all the teams throughout the season. But
let us know, too, if there's a specific team or game you want us to cover. I think it was last year, maybe the year before, that someone commented and was like, please talk about, I think it was Aston Villa. Please Aston talk Villa, about Aston Villa. And we like dedicated a section to him. So totally. There's just too many games to talk about in an episode. So let us know.
And we definitely have opinions on all these things. It's not like we just focus on these like fixtures and are like, oh, we don't care about the rest. Like
we have to talk about our own clubs, and then we got to pick and choose. So
yeah.
Right.
So let us know.
Absolutely right. Well, one thing that there was quite a bit of buzz about on social media, as we've been posting, you know, various items and things to get hyped for the new season, was there is some disgruntlement about our treatment of West Ham in the season premiere.
Rob.
And in our prediction at Rob. So let's discuss. I think we gave a lot of our reasons for why they're getting relegated, but let's have someone.
We have the full panel here. Ethan's the non-relegator. Here.
Okay, well, Ethan, you are going to be the man to play devil's advocate then. I was going to let it be whoever, but you have to play devil's advocate. Why are they staying up?
Well, I mean, you know, you give these good reasons for, like, you know, dealing with Europa League and, you know, obviously losing the person who held them down in the midfield, like Declan Rice, and then probably losing Paquetá. But I still think they have quality there, like better than other teams that are in the league right now.
My question to that is, how have they improved from last season?
I don't think they've improved. I'm just saying I still think it's better than a lot of these teams.
Have they gotten worse? Because I would say yes.
I mean, yeah, but I still think it's better than a lot of these teams and some of these teams.
What I will say, and I'm with you, Reese, but what I will say is I think there are teams that have gotten worse at a higher magnitude of getting worse than West Ham. Like, I think Wolves is the number one example. Well, is there more? I don't know. Everton probably got worse. If they can get worse, I don't know.
They're signing Jack Harrison.
True.
Which I know doesn't instantly make them better, but
sorry. Well, I actually think it does. It's better than signing Ashley Young to play that position.
Yeah,
so.
For sure.
Yeah. And I'm not sitting here and saying that West Ham are definitely not going to get relegated. Like, it's still a possibility. It looks like it's going to happen, you know, sometimes, you know, with all these things going around of them signing a lot of Deadwood players. But
Some of those are even falling through. They're not even signing Maguire anymore, which may be good, in my opinion. But.
Yeah. Well, they've moved on to Mavropanos. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, my God. No way.
That's their new center back target.
Wow.
They're getting relegated, dude.
Yeah. That's a disastrous signing. But I will. Okay. Here's another thing to play devil's advocate. They did just add a cheat code for 10 free goals a season by signing Ward-Prowse because he's going to score set pieces for free. The thing about that signing, though, is yes, he buys you goals, but I actually think in terms of his play in the midfield in open play, he's a downgrade on a lot of what they already had. Like, I think he's a downgrade on Suchek in open play.
Yeah, and he's definitely, example. I mean, he's got, I would say, none of the qualities that Declan Rice had.
No.
He's bringing new qualities, but I think genuinely none of the qualities Declan Rice offered.
No, and yeah, I just don't see. It just doesn't, nothing that they're doing inspires me. And like Josh said last season, when it goes so long without them making a signing, it's just instantly concerning. And we all sat here, well, I especially sat here and told Josh, no, Leicester will be fine. Like, they're not going to get relegated. There's too much quality in the team. They made some, you know, questionable signings, one signing ever. Didn't address their problem areas. And I was like, no, you know what? They'll be fine. They won't get relegated. And then last day of the season comes and they're going down. And I think we said it a lot last season that if you're not moving forward in the Premier League, if you're not moving forward in the Premier League, you're moving backwards. And I think that's absolutely the case for West Ham right now. So.
Yeah. And I
my staked claim.
Yeah. I do agree with a lot of what y'all are saying. It makes total sense. But when I think about like the West Ham and Leicester comparison, I think West Ham do have the ability to score goals. The defense is like their worst thing right now, their problem area. But it's like the opposite for Leicester. I thought their defense was pretty solid for the most part, and they just couldn't score. So it might be different. It might be similar. I think we'll let the rest of the season decide. And there's still time in the transfer window. So I don't know. It's hard to think that they'll go down, but it definitely could happen.
It is worth noting, too, your friend, your close friend is a West Ham fan, is not feeling very hopeful.
He definitely doesn't think they're going to get relegated. But it doesn't seem up. The morale is very down, but we'll see.
I mean, I brought it up to you, and I know you already had your counterpoint. It's just, I want to bring it up again because I think it's just kind of my one issue is that they have not gotten better, and I would argue to the death that they have gotten worse for sure. And
I agree with that.
I just
that.
Don't think it bodes very well.
No, I agree with you. I'm just saying you know, this is me contradicting myself because I'm just saying, you know, it's only been one game so far in a 38-game season. But I if you put them up against the teams close around them at the bottom, like Sheffield, maybe Everton, I think that they win those games. So we'll see, though. I could totally, this could be like, you know, way in the future. I'll put it in like a clip that I like defended them. They'll be like bottom.
Black and white.
Yeah.
After they get relegated after match week 21.
Yeah, this will be definitely something to revisit down the line.
I am also not without bias. I hate them. So
yeah, I hate them too. So
yeah.
Let's bring things to a final conclusion, gentlemen. I want to say a huge thanks to Ethan for doing the album of the week, which I almost forgot.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were gonna forget or not. Yeah, I got a good one this time. I discovered, well, I guess not discovered, but I had started listening to him, you know, I think maybe a few months ago. And one of the songs that he sings is probably one of my favorite love songs of all time. It's just great. But he's got an amazing voice. This is Jeff Buckley's Grace. Do you know this one, Gage?
Dude, I was listening to this album like,
awesome.
Literally 2 hours ago.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. And I literally, this is a funny story because, you know, we had recently had Josh's wedding maybe a few months ago.
Look, that's what I have playing on Spotify right now. This is real
time.
That's
awesome. I'm glad it worked out. But Lover, You Should Have Come Over might be one of the best written love songs of all time. And I'll stand by that. Literally the day of Josh's wedding, I was getting ready, like showering. I was weeping singing that song on the day of his wedding. It's just such a good love song.
You need to talk to brother Ethan because he put literally my whole family. I mean, not my whole family. My parents knew about him already, but he put us all on Jeff Buckley a little while back.
Yeah. He's just got a really nice voice. It's a shame what happened to him because he died very young and there's not many albums, but I really, some of the lyrics in that song, and he's got a bunch of other good songs on that album too. It's just a phenomenal album, but like some of the words he describes for loving someone so much is just, it's like literal poetry. So everyone definitely check out that album and at least check out Lover, You Should Come Over.
Absolutely right. And his cover of Hallelujah might be the greatest cover of all time. That he is downright angelic on that song.
Yes, sir.
So let's try that again. I am now going to bring the show to a full close now that I'm not forgetting our additional segments. This time I'm going to say a huge thank you to Ethan for coming back on the show this week. So shout out to you, Ethan. Thanks for coming back on.
Absolutely. I'm glad the season's back and I'm glad we're back to normal schedule and, you know, chucking away at all the games.
And Reese, thank you for espousing your nonsense once again.
Yes. Thank you for hosting once again.
Yes.
And thank you to the listener, of course, for coming along with us. We hope you're enjoying the start of the Premier League season. We hope you're enjoying the start of our coverage as well. Follow us on all the socials at SlapcastPL.
Websites in the works.
In the works. SlapcastPL.com. It will be here. So
it will. It will be here no matter what.
Yeah, just like Kylian Mbappe.
Yeah.
Who will not be there next season. So he's ruining the meme. But either way, that's it from us. We want to say we love you all. And it's a goodbye from us.